Thank you so much, Rick. I don't believe I deserve half of what, am I on here? Half of what was said about me here. I'm, you know, an economist by training, and when an economist is the only thing that is standing between you and your next meal, it's a pretty dangerous place to be. You might wonder, okay, well, how does somebody who is a God-fearing, Bible-believing Christian who believes with all my heart that you don't get connected with God until you have gone through an experience of dying to yourself, and we've just heard stories about how Helena has had to die to herself repeatedly, how do you then turn that around and become somebody who purports to know the future? It almost seems a little sacrilegious. I had somebody at work just in the last couple of days say, you know, your profession used to be called black magic. I thought, okay, well, that's an interesting one. Ever heard about the four spiritual laws? You know, and I sort of ask myself, well, the arrogance of this, you know, there is only one who knows the future. That's not me. And so how does somebody get into this business? And what on earth can a Christian actually share in this context? Can you actually stand in front of people and talk like you know what is actually going to happen? Is that the right thing to do? Or is it not? Well, it sure helps when you know who knows the future. And I will say, and I've actually said to groups, there was a send-off for me when I left the Conference Board of Canada, and I said, you know, I can hardly remember a time when either something that I wrote or a speech that I was getting up to give or something along those lines that I didn't actually commit that to the Lord in prayer. And this is a group of very secular, liberal-minded folks that I was in front of there, but this was my opportunity to make a stand and just to say how I live my life. And I will say that given the way the world is going in the last little while, I'm a very popular guy at just about everything I show up at. You know, if people want to know the future, you know, and it's been a pretty rocky ride over the last little while. Now, I wouldn't claim, and Rob knows this, to have a perfect record on what it is that's going on out there. I can tell you every single misstep that I've made in my career. But I will say that when I have engaged in a prayer that I pray quite frequently, and it's grounded in the wisdom book of Scripture, Proverbs, praying for wisdom and knowledge and understanding and discernment and discretion are advised right from the get-go in that book that was written by the wisest leader who ever lived. And I go to that book for wisdom counseling, and my staff know that I quote wise Solomon. I don't say that I'm quoting the Bible here, but I quote the wisest king who ever lived, and they're aware of these proverbs. They come out in my conversation, and I don't know how they feel about this because that all gets talked about behind closed doors, but I do believe that the prayer that Solomon prayed, that God honored, is something that we can pray as well. It's a noble prayer to pray, to ask for wisdom and the ability to do something that is otherwise an impossible task. And so I'm very thankful that when the major movements happened in the economy over the last 10 years, I feel like I and my team were given extraordinary wisdom to be able to see beyond some of the biggest things that occurred. I joke with my former boss, who is now running the Bank of Canada, because I said, Steve, you're a better forecaster than I am. Because you handed the keys of the chief economist job at EDC to me in May of 2008. You know what happened after that? Helena was caught up in the thing that actually affected everybody around the world. But, you know, we got through that period of time because in the fall of 2007, we looked at the leading indicators and said, you know, something something is going to happen in the second half of 2008 that is a major event in the world economy. We were able to say that, and it's actually documented now. And while a famous Bay Street chief economist was going around talking about $200 oil, I was out on the road saying $70 by the end of the year. And it was going 100, 110, 120. Howard Green had me on BNN with the Calgary skyline behind me. And I said $70 by the end of the year, and I've never seen somebody for the press do a head fake like this live on TV. And he said, Peter, it just crossed 120. I said, yes, and this is the first half of the year. In the second half of the year, something is going to happen. And I was wrong, because at the end of 2008, it was actually $35 a barrel, not 70. And that's the kind of thing that I'm not sure if I'll ever do it again. It was pretty traumatic at the time. But that's the kind of thing. And right through the sequence of what has happened over the last 10 years, I believe we've been given extraordinary wisdom. There is a lot that has happened. The greatest recession that has happened since the Great Depression. The period of stimulus, which we said was going to be short-lived, and others said, no, this is the real recovery. And we stuck our necks out on the line. And what have we had? 7 years of sluggish growth that everybody's calling a new normal. And we said that was going to happen, but we said it wasn't going to last forever. We said there was going to be a recovery at the end of that, and we timed that, and the recovery in the U.S. met that timetable, and now the resurgence that we are seeing is causing major institutions around the world to revise their forecasts up for the first time in 7 years. And those who have been following us know. And these guys are saying, well, we don't know why this is happening. And the story that I'm about to tell you is a story that I believe we've been given to tell to business audiences for their good. Now, I don't want you to think I've got a direct pipeline in there and that everything that I say is something that you can put your money on the table for. Disclaimer, 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 okay? But let's go through the story. I just want to be very clear to give God the glory for what I believe he has enabled me to do as I go across the country serving him in this crazy profession. So, what is the story behind what has happened? What has guided us over this period of time to be able to make calls like we have made? Well, it's a very simple thing. I go back and I look at the business cycle. All right, let's go way back, okay? I'm going to take you back to 1970. 1970 was a long time ago, and it was before any of the major free trade deals were going on. Global trade intensity, which is the amount of exports and imports around the world divided by overall gross domestic product, hardly moved over that time. Small increases in that. Very little new globalization was going on. Something happened in the mid-1980s to turn that curve up. Global integration started to increase at that point, and the break in that series was structural, very dramatic. What caused that to happen? That's when free trade deals started to get inked. Our free trade agreement with the United States, the first landmark large free trade agreement, followed by NAFTA, followed by a Canada-Chile free trade agreement, followed by free trade agreements around the world. We were first past the post, showed people what to do, and global integration started. At the same time, we have an upsurge in technology that brings into this increasingly international fold economies that were otherwise shut out of the international picture. China starts to come on the scene. Very gingerly, India starts to come on the scene. Some of the South American economies start coming on the scene. Mexico, as a result of NAFTA, comes into the fore as well. Global integration is starting to happen in a very big way. Now, what happened at the same time as this is in fact a debunking of the mythology that is being sold south of the border at this point in time, that trade is the cause of all of our problems. You know that this advent inside of the economy has actually taken what is normally a 10-year business cycle and doubled it. It has stretched out the business cycle. Don't let anybody tell you that this is a hollowing out of Western economies that happens with a process like this, that all of our jobs are going to Mexico or they're going to China or somewhere like that. Through this period of time, in Western economies, unemployment rates still hit some of the greatest lows that we have ever seen in their history, even the United States of America. All right, so we have globalization that transforms things. You know, when you get a standard economic cycle, what kicks off a recession is at the end of that cycle, you get so drunk, let's say, with the amount of successive growth that you have had, that we all lower our risk threshold and we start doing silly things. We start over-consuming. Businesses over-invest in order to keep up with the over-consumption. A bubble is generated inside of the economy. The bubble bursts, and that's when you get a recession. That expunges the excesses out of the economy. You get back on with growth. When you have a 16-year cycle, folks, that goes into overdrive. Around year 9, year 10, year 11, somebody comes along and says, wow, it really is different this time. By the way, when somebody tells you, somebody like me tells you that it's different this time, sell everything. Okay. That's a killer phrase. But this was a stretched out cycle. And at that point in time, people said, well, you know, this has gone on longer than it normally does. And you know what that got us to do? We really lowered our risk threshold, got out there, and we had a period of excess in the global economy that lasted almost as long as a full economic cycle. Can you imagine the size of that bubble? You take that bubble, add globalization to it, and export it everywhere. Boy, oh boy, you're setting yourself up for a big down in the economy at some point in time. The trouble is, when a bubble goes on for long enough, somebody comes along and says, hey, this is a new normal. That's exactly what they called it at that time. And we thought, well, you know, the rules inside of the economy are being broken at the moment in terms of average consumption and so forth. Something is wrong with this. But it was sustained for quite a period of time. And so it kicked that line up even further and set us up for the greatest drop in activity globally that we have seen, as I said before, since the Great Recession. Now what we have is this period at the end there, which is flat, which, guess what? Guess what they're calling that? They're calling that a new normal too. Just take that phrase and flush it, okay? Because it's really unhelpful. You know, new normal is a tag that is put on an economic phenomenon when it lasts long enough and people don't know how to explain it. This period of flat here, that's what that's being called. And that doesn't look very inspiring. It does look sort of new normal-ish. It does look like, you know, we are caught in something that we can't get out of. And people will give you all kinds of reasons why that's our perpetual state now. But if you draw a little line through this and say, you know, globalization is continuing, and if this global trade intensity can be foreseen to increase in a linear way, guess what just happened? Those lines just crossed, as you can see. You know what that means? That means this period of getting rid of the excesses that piled up ahead of the last recession. It's taken an awful long time for that to happen, but it was a big, big excess. We are now back at the business, according to this chart, of growing again. And the question is, do we see any evidence of that inside of the global economy? Let's start with the number one economy of the world and let's have a look at it. Well, it sure looks like that. Sure looks like things are going well in the United States. Down, when you're talking about an unemployment rate, is a really good direction. Okay, and this is what's happening here, a 4.1% unemployment rate in the United States. And so there's been a lot of ballyhooing about that. This is a really positive development inside of the U.S. economy. They've been generating jobs successively for dozens and dozens of months. That hardly ever happens. And so you might say, okay, well, this is good. This is looking, though, like the end of a cycle. Is this the end of a cycle? Are we about to have another recession in the United States? Well, this isn't the real unemployment rate, folks. That's the one that gets published. But the real unemployment rate is this. Now, that sounds really convenient, right? When the data's not saying what you want it to say, just make up another series. I learned that in some of my first years of economics, you know. Very handy tool to have. This is the Peter Hall unemployment rate. No, the reason that that is the effective unemployment rate, and Janet Yellen is actually using this down in the States at the moment, it's not funny money. Normally, when an unemployment rate is coming down, what would you expect people to do in the economy? Participate more or participate less in the economy? Well, an unemployment rate comes down. A lot of people were kicked out of the economy when the unemployment rate shot up. They're interested in coming back in again, right? Except in the United States, for this entire period of time, the rate of labor force participation has dropped. And you throw that at an economist and say, explain that one to me, and not a lot of people have answers for that. Even if you layer into this the aging of the population and say, okay, maybe that's the trend that participation should have been on, you still have a massive gap between the number of people who are now participating in the labor force versus the number that should be. And when you take all of those people that have been kicked out of the labor force, they're neither employed nor unemployed, and they said, I'm fed up with this, you know, there's no way, I'm just going to sit on the sidelines because things are so bad. You throw all of those into the unemployed, where they should be, and that's the unemployment rate that you get. So the U.S. economy is doing well, the unemployment rate is coming down, but that's where it would be if all these people were gainfully employed. And that means the United States has anywhere from 3 to 8 more years to grow. We are not on the verge of a recession. But you might say, okay, well, you've hardly convinced us that things are turning around here. You know, that participation rate doesn't really look like it's going anywhere. Well, a very significant group of people is buried inside of that decreasing part rate, millennials. Millennials have been left out of the picture in droves in this recovery. Why does that occur? When the economy falls apart and you just happen to graduate in that year and you don't have a whole lot of hope and you don't have a whole lot of experience, you don't have much to offer the marketplace out there, companies aren't going to be very interested in you. And you know, we have been asking the millennial generation in the United States, in Western Europe, and in other OECD countries to wait 7 years for their first meaningful job. That's a very long period of time in anybody's life. It's an even longer chunk of anybody's career. So this group of people is mighty discouraged at this point in time. You know what I think is the greatest development that the world economy has seen in the last 12 to 18 months? Millennials are coming back. You ready? Look at that. The jump from the lowest point in this chart to where it is right now is 1.6 million American millennials who have come into the marketplace in a way that we have not seen over the last 7 years. And I believe this is illustrating a turning point. Now you might say, okay, millennials. I mean, they've been living in the basement of their parents' house for the last 7 years, playing video games, all right? How useful are they in the marketplace at the moment? I mean, they're lazy. They don't like buying cars. They're not interested in houses. They're not forming families. What is wrong with this group of people? It's like opportunity is wrong with these people. They haven't had hope because of that. Now the economy is turning around, and look at the number of them that are coming into the marketplace. You might say, okay, well, that's great for them, but they're hardly the wealthiest people coming into the marketplace. Well, they might be saddled with student debts, and they might have, you know, a bit of a confidence problem after all of these years. But folks, these are what we call first wave consumers. They do buy their first car. They buy their first house. They form a family for the first time after putting it off for many years because they just didn't have a whole lot to offer. And when they're taken out of the economy for 7 years, you feel it. And when they come back into the economy again, boy, it's a dynamo inside of the economy that gets things going that haven't been going for these last 7 years. What do I mean by that? Look at the housing market in the United States. I don't have a handy-dandy chart on that, but it's one part of the market in the United States that has never recovered. It has never recovered because it doesn't have this feeder demand coming in. We might have housing bubbles in Toronto. We might have a housing bubble in Vancouver, and that might be getting exported across our country, but that is not America's experience over the last little while. Ahead of the Great Recession, they were building about 2 million houses. That was too many. They need 1.4 million. So they were creating a massive bubble there. This is almost perfectly illustrative of the way the market crashed. They were building above 2 million units. They came down to 500,000 units. right across the industry. Did that sink in? A 75% drop in activity right across the industry? Can you imagine your own business sustaining that and being stuck there for 2.5 years? There has been a hollowing out of U.S. construction. And so everybody thought it was great when this market recovered from 500,000 units to 1.2 million units. It's more than a doubling. That's great. We'll take it. And they still haven't got to the basic level of household replacement inside of the United States, 1.4 million units. And you know that every month that that number is below 1.4 million units, a large and growing deficit of U.S. housing is occurring. Well, why do I go on about housing? You know, it's a small part of the economy and so forth. You know what? It's one of the most reliable leading indicators of activity of anywhere else in the economy. And what I've just told you is there's massive pent-up demand in the number one market of the world that is going to drive that market up double digits over the next 12 to 18 months. You know why it's not doing that right now, by the way? It's been down for so long, they don't have capacity to create capacity in that industry. They don't have skills, the skilled labor force that they need for that industry. But the demand is there, and it's being reflected in prices across the economy. Well, I still didn't answer the question. Why the housing market? It's a small part of what's going on. If it's a leading indicator of activity, folks, it's ahead of all the other things that are going to grow at similar rates. We're talking about the number one economy of the world being on the verge of a real recovery that sounds to me like old normal. Now, is it just the United States? Folks, there are millennials all over the world that are less into houses than they ever were before, yellow bar, but that want to get into a house in the next 5 years in huge numbers, red bar. That's pretty cool. And that's not people's normal perception of this generation. They're ready to move. And what I'm telling you is that not only in the United States, but in Western Europe, they are actually on the march. Everybody excited by that? Is that good news for everybody? After waiting for so long, something is actually coming our way. That's pretty good. So is it just that part of the marketplace? I got to speed up here. It's not that part of the marketplace. It's other parts of the U.S. marketplace as well. Do you know what happens on the business side of things when you have a bubble? Businesses see that it's a bubble because they're very smart, right? And so they say, I don't want any part of that frenzied activity. Somebody else can have all of that. I'm going to be really prudent, and I'm going to say, that's a bubble, so I don't want that activity. Any of you act like that? Absolutely not, right? If there's a bubble out there, you want the best piece of that bubble you can get. And so you invest to be able to service that bubble because you don't really know it's a bubble at the time, right? And what are you left with when the economy crashes? All that capital that you put into place to service that higher level of activity. And if it's the biggest bubble that we have seen in our lifetimes and even beyond that, it's going to be a long time before you need to invest again. This has been a world of chronic underinvestment over the last number of years. But now something magical has happened. The growth that we have seen over the last 7 years has sopped up extra capacity in most industries in the United States. Capacity utilization rates in the United States, in Western Europe, even here in Canada, are getting very close to or surpassing previous peaks. Did you hear that? Now, chronic underinvestment is what does that. You just haven't been replacing at the rate you've needed to. The economy picks up, you squeeze everything inside of your plant, and you're stuck because now you've got a problem. You're not going to be able to make orders going forward. What's the first thing that you do? Put up a plant? It's going to take a few years to do that, right? So the first thing that you can do is get machinery and equipment, new stuff that is increasing your run rates, increasing your productivity inside of your plant. And folks, that's what this illustrates. You see the end of that chart there and how it started to take off? I believe that we're at the near end of a new wave of investment in the United States. And the place that it starts is machinery and equipment in these two categories. All right, so how am I doing for time, Rick? -6? No, I'm just kidding. Okay, quickly on Western Europe then. What's going on there? Well, here's a chart that illustrates Western European capacity utilization. The yellow chart there, you can see how that line right across 19 countries in Western Europe is back to previous peak. That's pretty cool. They're on the verge of an investment cycle as well. They're a little bit further behind with respect to their unemployment rate, but what you need to know about that is that it's going down as fast as it is in the United States, and it's pulling their millennials into the market as well. Not convinced? Look at how confident EU business people are. Now, I don't know if you noticed it in the past chart there, but Europe had two recessions. They had one recession, and then they waved their hands and they said, yeah, this is a U.S. thing. It's not really affecting us. They stimulated their economy, looked like they were back to recovery. They got really proud about that, and then they realized they had overspent. They pulled that money off the table, double-dip recession. Double-dip recession is almost catastrophic for an economy, because if you have one recession, you start putting your money back on the table again, you get a second recession, you've lost money twice in this thing now, it's going to be an awfully long time before you're feeling good about getting back into the marketplace. And folks, that time is now. Look at that confidence in the marketplace. Look at the confidence in the construction sector. Look at how low it was for so long, and now that thing is going up like a rocket. That's what pent-up demand does inside of an economy. I'm telling you, there is pent-up demand in the construction sector big time in Western Europe. And they know it. They can see that. They can see their orders rising and their prosperity coming back again. This is just data, folks. I haven't made anything up here. I didn't even make up that series with the unemployment rate, okay? So, all right, what about consumers? They are more confident than they were back in 2007 before any of this happened. What? No standing ovation? Like, this is awesome stuff, folks, that is going on. All right, what am I telling you here? I'm saying the United States economy, number one economy in the world, Western Europe, which is just as big as the United States economy, both firing up like this. We haven't seen this for a long, long time. Many out there don't know how to explain this. We've been saying all the way along, this is going to happen. This is what an economy looks like when it's coming back. So what about emerging markets inside of all of this? Is hearing scary stories about China? Hearing scary stories about Mexico? Scary stories about India, maybe? Brazil? With all of that's going on in their construction industry and with political corruption? Well, very quickly here, China is doing well. And I believe that China is going to be a place that Canada can do a tremendous amount of business going forward. China's problem is keeping its economy going. China is tagged with a whole lot of baggage, I believe. But when you look at the Chinese economy and what it's trying to do, you try to fill 1.3 billion mouths with square meals three times a day and see how easy that is. Now, what about growth inside of China? People are worried because they're fearing that it's sinking down to the 6% level. Do you know that at 6% growth now, the Chinese economy adds as much GDP as it took 18% to generate way back in 2004 to 2008? That's the power of compound growth in an economy, folks. So 6% now puts as much pressure on the world's resources as 18% did just a few years ago. Now, when you let that sink in and you realize that we're forecasting 6.5% growth this year, we're seeing an acceleration on that, and I can easily see upward room on that growth up to the 8% level. You might think, you're crazy. Nobody else is forecasting that right now for China. And if China at 6% is that powerful, what about a China at 8% plus? What's that going to do to the rest of the world? Well, the reason that I'm taking that position is if world trade comes back, Chinese trade intensity crumbled in the Great Recession and has never come back. Global trade comes back, China starts participating in that trade, something like what it was doing before, you can add a half to a full percentage point to the bottom line in China. Did I say Japan? I didn't mean to say that. I meant China. On the consumer side, the government in China is trying to get Chinese people to save less. Now, you guys in this room, you're all good savers, but most Canadians aren't. Most Canadians save about 4% of every paycheck, and that would be in a good year. Do you know what the average Chinese person saves? 40%. 40. Now, the Chinese government says that's way too much. You got to save less, folks. This is holding our economy back. Do you know that if the average Chinese person lowered their savings rate by 2% every year, they could do that for 10 years, by the way, and still have an extraordinarily high savings rate. Every year, lowering it by 2% would add 1.6% direct GDP growth to the Chinese economy. And you know what? The Chinese government wants to do this. And the Chinese government is sort of known for getting what it wants, right? And so I think that when you look at that and say, all right, so you go and do that as a Chinese government for 1 year, and everybody sees how much prosperity that generates, they sort of get it at that point, right? We can lower our savings rate, and it's not the end of the world. And I believe that they're going to succeed in doing this, and I believe that that's something that we need to get ready for. Okay, there's more that I could say about the Chinese economy. The One Belt, One Road thing is a very big... this isn't working for me anymore. Oh, it's because it's zero. This is not working. Oh, there we go. It's not a conspiracy at all. Okay. There are other things that we could say about these emerging markets. I'm going to very quickly bring it back to the Canada story. And I wanted to say a whole pile of things about NAFTA that I'm not able to say now. This is people power.
So I've got a whack of questions. So one is on NAFTA.
Okay.
So why don't you just address what's happening in the U.S. with some of the protectionism challenges to NAFTA, okay. How that might affect...
Wrap up in 2 minutes. I've never done this before. Okay. NAFTA is not going to get torn up. There are 7 good reasons for that. 1, the employment effects on the United States. 2, the effects on U.S. prices. 3, the fact that this is just round one that we're talking about, and no trade war is just one country acting. Action, reaction. 4, you can impose costs right away in an economy. You can't get the investment to come in quickly. And the investment that will come in from the costs that would be imposed by tearing up NAFTA would occur after the midterm elections and potentially after the next presidential election. That's a losing policy right there. Competitiveness. You build walls around your economy in an anti-trade kind of way, and you're the high-cost producer. And I don't care whether the United States of America or not, that's not going to work. Technology enabled free trade and globalization around the world. And I don't think any economy, not even the United States, can ring-fence themselves from technology. Technology will find a way of doing globalization, and it will get around whatever barrier is out there. And my final point, that was 6 points right there real quick. My final point is, if growth is happening, why bother? Why wreck that architecture if you can actually check off every policy box that you've promised the American people just by looking out the window and seeing what's going on right now? Okay, so how do I bring this all home to Canada? I said 2 main things here. I said the economies of the world are firing up for the first time in 7 years. I'm saying the greatest threat to Canadian international trade and perhaps to global international trade is not going to happen. And I needed more time to unpack that for you guys. I could be more convincing if I had more minutes. But if that's not going to happen, and that's scaring a lot of people away from the marketplace right now because they don't know what kind of international trade architecture we're going to have over the next little while. If that's not going to happen, and by the way, it not happened all over Western Europe in the elections that they had this year. They all came out on the side of trade. America's the only place that's messing around with the trade picture at the moment. If that's the case, what I'm talking about across Canada is this could be our greatest opportunity, economy-wise, it's come to us in a long, long time. What do I mean by that? If the opportunity, if the growth is out there, if it's going to be with us for a number of years, and everybody else is running for cover because they don't know what things are going to look like, wouldn't it be great to move into that void, take advantage of that, and get some of the best opportunities that you might have in your lifetime? Now you might say, well, it's easy for an economist sitting behind a computer screen to come up with something like that. I got serious money that I've got to put on the table. Like, do you got any more you can give me on that? Well, I took this gutsy message down to Mexico in week one of the administration. I told four audiences that he wasn't going to do it. I felt pretty good about myself when I was in downtown Mexico eating my lunch on Thursday afternoon until I looked at my phone and realized that he did it. I told four audiences in four cities he wasn't going to do it. And the day I was done, he did it. 20% border adjustment tax against Mexico. I thought, my career is over. All those stories I told you about being accurate, gone. Except in 1 hour, Sean Spicer stands up and says, "Ooh, that's just one of five options the president is considering right now. Well, that's a little different than what the president said." By the end of the day, the president himself gets up and he steals a line out of my speech. Well, it's the same line. You didn't know it was my speech, I guess. What did he say? He said, "We cannot do this because it will raise costs for the American public. And that doesn't make America great again, so we're not going to do it." Now, I wondered, well, you could have saved me a lot of heart failure if you'd thought about that at 9 o'clock in the morning when you woke up. But you know what those people down in Mexico, even although this was their darkest hour and they were worried about what their future was going to look like, you know what they said to me? I had companies come up to me and say, "You know, we haven't understood why it is that we are having the doors open to us to supply chains that we've always wanted to be a part of. We've never been invited in. We've banged on these doors, never gotten in. Now the doors are opening up for us. Should we do that? We're not sure. But what you've told us today, this dynamic here, makes a lot of sense to us, and it's going to cause us to at least consider going for that business." Well, I'm trying to make sure that I can't be accused of keeping Canadian exporting businesses apart from what I think is one of the greatest upturns of growth that we're going to see, and the opportunities that are being created by those who choose not to be a part of it. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
So I, as you can imagine, I've got a bunch of questions here. So I'll try to go through as many as we can. But Peter is hanging around. You're here for the dinner, correct? Right. So you know what he looks like. You know where to find him. He'll be around here. And I'll give you his room number at the hotel also in case...
I'm not at this hotel.
I know that. I know, but the hotel he's at is not very far away, so that's no problem.
There's lots of hotels not very far away from here.
All right. So I think there's some obvious questions. So what about housing, or what people would describe as the housing bubble, whether Vancouver or Toronto?
So on this note, I mean, I can be negative when I need to be, and I am quite negative on the Canadian housing market. I'm not as negative as Capital Economics. The guy who works there used to work for me. And I'm not that kind of doomsayer about our economy, because a very strange thing is going on in our economy. Yes, we have excesses inside of our domestic marketplace, and that's a long story I don't have time for. But we have a bubble, not just in Toronto, not just in Vancouver. We've got a bit of a real estate bubble happening across the country. Our consumers, which are 60% of our GDP, have an indebtedness ratio of 170%. That's the debt to disposable income ratio. And that's higher than it was in the United States ahead of the Great Recession. So that's not a comforting statistic. The Bank of Canada starts raising interest rates on that kind of debt load, and boy, it's going to be effective. That's why our interest rate forecast does not have us raising rates at the same pace as in the United States. That's one of the things that's actually keeping our dollar low. But we are going to see something happen. What rescues us is that we have different cycles going on in different parts of our economy. And this is highly unusual, but there are good reasons for it. So at the same time as global trade collapsed in 2008, we lost, by the way, one quarter of all of Canada's merchandise trade, just like that, in that recession. One quarter. Gone. What rescued us was we had a balanced domestic economy there. So when the U.S. economy, when the U.S. housing market crashed by 75%, we went down by 25%. Sorry, 33%. That, you might say, well, still pretty bad. We recovered from that really quickly because we had balance in our marketplace. Low interest rates, stimulative policy on the fiscal side of things created or helped to create a domestic sector bubble in our economy. But that's about to burst at the same time as we have exports taking off. So we're just unusually blessed at this point in time. We have offsetting parts of the economy, and that's what prevents a housing collapse from spilling into the rest of the economy and causing mayhem. I don't believe that that's going to occur.
So you alluded to interest rates. So where do you see interest rates in the coming year then?
So the Bank of Canada has surprised just about everybody with the way that it's moving interest rates at the moment. And so when it was cutting rates, when commodity prices came down, they surprised people. Now that they're raising interest rates, they're surprising people on the way up. So you might say, well, how do you forecast that? Well, when you look at the impact that those interest rate increases are having versus their contemporaries in the United States, we do not have a lot of room to move upward. So we're looking at U.S. interest rates that over the next 2-3 years are going to normalize, which takes them into the low 3% zone. It is going to take Canada at least another year to get to that point, if it even gets that far.
So I have a very serious question here. The mustache, is it just for Movember? See, that he, now he's hesitating.
Okay.
Okay, we can.
All right. No videos. Okay.
It is being recorded, but we can delete this section.
Shoot. Well, I was going to do my governor of the Bank of Canada imitation, but I guess I just can't do that.
All right. So you don't have to answer.
No.
Normally has the mustache.
I've got a story to tell. I've always got a story to tell. The only time my wife has seen me without a mustache is when I shaved it off to imitate the governor of the Bank of Canada when he was leaving Export Development Canada to take on that job. So I got up there on the stage, and I was saying, like, you know, that's the way things are going to happen around here. And this is what gets you to take a mustache off. And if you don't know Mr. Poulos, if you don't know Mr. Poulos, you don't have a flying clue why I just talk like that. But that's what he sounds like.
So, last question, just on the dollar. So, where do you see the dollar in the coming year?
So, the dollar reacted or overreacted when the Bank of Canada jolted markets. And so it went up to 82, 83 cents momentarily. And people were worried about it. If you think about the dollar on the flip side, they were worried about it going to 120, 115, you know, appreciating. And I was getting lots of questions at that point in time about it going to parity. Well, when something's doing this, you know, people are just feel you can draw a straight line through that and it's going to continue going up. And my word at the time was, this is way too high. This is an overshoot. It had gone from 75 cents US up to 82, 83 cents US, and basically was moving based on what the Bank of Canada was doing. Now, the currency should have gone up, but not nearly that much. What they were forward pricing into the currency was 200 basis points of interest rate increases that they had not factored in before, and that was ridiculously high. No way. I mean, everybody was knowing that interest rates were going to go up, but to say that they had missed it to the tune of 200 basis points was utterly ridiculous. So we said, look, this is an overreaction. It's going to come back down. It's going to come back down to roughly the 78 cent range, and that's exactly what it's done. And so we're seeing it rising modestly from there to about the 83 cent US level by the time we get to 2021. There's a whole story behind that. We've got a five-part dollar model. I can talk with anybody about that anytime this evening that you want to. But based on that model, that's how we're seeing the dollar behave over the next number of years.
Great. Thanks. Can we thank Peter again? That was great. So I have to ask, did Peter just exceed your expectations of any economist? And And we will have a recording, although we'll take out the mustache part. All right, we've got around 12, 13 minutes left, and there's one last thing we'll do. And part of this is a bit of the philosophy behind the event. What we want to do is expose people to a range of entrepreneurial concepts, speakers, and ideas. And so the next individual I'll have up here for about 5 minutes or so. So Mario will speak for 5 minutes, and I'll do a quick Q&A with him for 5 minutes. And the purpose is that Mario is from the Dominican Republic and works with Edudeo Ministries and is doing some pretty entrepreneurial things in the nonprofit sector. I'll just read his bio up, and then he's going to come up here and share. And then after he's finished sharing, I'll have him sit over here for 5 minutes. And if you've got some questions, then fire away. Mario was born and lives in Santo Domingo, Dominican Republic. He has served as evangelist, church planter, and community development worker since 1990, and is the founder and executive director of the Center for Transforming Missions, Dominican Republic, CTMD, a faith-based nonprofit dedicated to the training and mobilization of leaders who work for social and spiritual renewal of marginalized communities in the Dominican Republic. He also leads a network of 16 schools that directly serve 3,500 children in grades pre-K to 12. Mario's passion is to equip and mentor other leaders and to develop the organizational capacity of those serving the poor and marginalized communities. And the reason Mario, if you can come on up. So the reason I like to include people like Mario, include a range of individuals, that we all know that it's not just financial resources that make a difference, but it's the entrepreneurial capacity, entrepreneurial creativity. So, Mario, look forward to your sharing.